positive as well as negative, and with some sense of what a party looks and feels like, and how essential it is that we learn from practice and error to form, before it is too late, a unified communist socialist bloc to the ever-impending fascist takeover in USA. It is also, although somewhat cumbersomely, quite moving at times, as Dennis recalls, some of the personal joys and anguishes of life as a communist for over a half a century. The book covers two very eventful lives, albeit with a great deal of frustration for the reader, since many of Gene's activities on behalf of the Comintern, he worked in China, South Africa, and the Philippines, among other assignments, occurred without his wife and are treated, therefore, primarily as absences. What Gene Dennis saw and did and learned during those times would have provided the materials for an understanding of the work of the Comintern, which has never been adequately done. But Gene Dennis died of cancer in 1961 and never wrote about that. Most interesting in the present work are its glimpses into the political struggles that raged within the leadership of the Communist Party USA over the years. Unfortunately, they are little more than glimpses. In general, Peggy Dennis, in her political estimate of her husband, is that he represented the best political force in the Communist Party USA, combating both the Reaganism of Earl Browder and the leftism of Foster. Even attributes such a view to the leadership in the Comintern, who he says promoted Gene Dennis in the party hierarchy as a balance between Browder and Foster. Browder finally sold out the Communist Party because of his religionism. Throughout the work, Peggy Dennis marks out rightist and leftist lines on major questions. Most of her criticism, though not all, is aimed at Foster and the leftists. She says that communists who participated in the great CIO organizing drive of the 1930s were puzzled by Foster's characterization of the movement as spontaneous, since they were helping make it happen. She clearly sees as sectarian Foster's call
that delineation between Browder and the line represented by her husband. Bypassing Browder's euphoric reliance on Roosevelt, the National Committee's post-election analysis emphasized the growing independent power and political consciousness of the working class, which influenced the Democratic Party in a progressive and democratic direction. Opposition to the formation of a National Farmer Labor Party at the time was expressed emphatically. The party would resist any such attempt. The document stated and would support all those measures of the Democratic Party and the Roosevelt administration which have a progressive character. One of Peggy Dennis's most interesting observations is on the dissolution of party caucuses within the trade unions in early 1939. Her attitude seems to be that not only was this the correct decision at the time, but that there was something inherently wrong with our procedure of meeting separately to determine the attitudes we would take at union meetings before even hearing the members' discussions or views. Of course, putting it this way loads the question, since it implies a mechanical rigidity which proper communist caucuses work would avoid. But then she goes on to say that these dissolutions did create other problems, which were not dealt with and therefore weakened our work. Freed from these rank-and-file caucus and party club controls, leading communists in the unions became elitist, who consulted only with individual party leaders, and practical union considerations increasingly dominated the party's political decisions. Here is a subject worthy of a book in its own right. Another intriguing comment, also in passing, is a note on some differences between the 11 national leaders of the Communist Party USA indicted under the dreadful Smith Act concerning the strategy to be pursued at their trial in the awful McCarthy era that is now beginning to show its Cold War ugly head again in USA.
One urged that the right to teach and advocate what the Smith Act prohibits, forcible overthrow, that is, armed struggle, the right to revolution, be defended. The majority decided that the right to revolution would be defended as a theoretical, historical concept. The defense they decided should be, as much as possible, within a context that could solicit the widest support from a very prejudiced American community against communism, which is again becoming increasingly bigoted against communism. It is worth recalling in this connection that 160 communists were arrested under the Smith Act during this period, and that 41 served long prison terms ranging from 3 to 8 years. Let this be kept in mind by all the present-day proponents of democratic transition to socialism, revisionism, that is, including some of these very same individuals. The threat posed by the communists of the early 1950s was unfortunately largely fanciful. It was very small indeed, and the majority of the USA was in a fascist, racist mood. Nevertheless, the bourgeoisie responded with massive repression, particularly as justification for what it hoped would be a decade of cold war against communism that might even lead to an international hot war. And again, we have the same conditions. Fear that USA is losing its economic base in Africa has whipped up international frenzies to recreate the Cold War hysteria between USA and the Soviet Union, and all inspired and created by the architects of USA monopoly capitalism. It is not hard to imagine what the bourgeoisie state will try to do when there is a strong working class movement with socialist objectives led by a genuine vanguard party, if ever it does exist in the United States, before genocide and concentration camps in an outright fascist takeover or the ultimate horror of nuclear war comes. One final distressing note along these lines is Peggy Dennis's confirmation of anti-Semitic attitudes in the Communist Party leadership, which she encountered in the 1972 Comintern. She quotes one upward-moving party activist who told her, speaking of another individual, "You can appreciate how capable he is. He holds such a responsible position, even though he is a Jew." I have not commented here on some of the more personal aspects of the narrative, but these two offer some useful insights into party life and party attitudes, particularly on such private matters as sex and marriage. It is thought that Peggy Dennis is primarily appealing to Jewish dissidents, as is always the case, to attempt to divide the Jews in U.S. American life from supporting working class international communist struggles by stating that there is prejudices against Jews in the Communist Party and in the Soviet Union, which indeed is an absolute lie. Jews still occupy the most leading and important roles in the Soviet government. There is anti-Zionist feeling because the State of Israel has become a fascist cancerous cell created in impossible conditions in the first place that would only bring out the worst flames of nationalism on the part of the Israelis as well as the Palestinians that were removed from their own land to make place for the imposed Zionist regime. Peggy Dennis left the Communist Party USA in 1975, more over the matter of the party's lack of independence from Moscow than any thorough critique of its present revisionist lines. She just wanted to play it safe because she feared future Cold War tensions. Unfortunately, she is unable to comprehend the nature of the present-day critique of revisionism. She seems to see it either as a new form of flunkyism toward China, some truth there, or as a return to the worst sectarianism of the Communist Party USA's early period. A little truth there, too, but there is strong need for a dogmatic solidarity, at least, based on much reflection, introspection, and democratic self-criticism, self-analysis, and group criticism, that if ever there was needed a position of authoritarian loyalty in the left in the USA is today, and it's already, no doubt, too late. But a party's independence is not an end in itself. To be independent of other parties is, of course, absolutely essential. But this hardly guarantees the development of a genuinely revolutionary line, merely because the Communist Party USA would attempt to break away from Moscow. Pivodinov, like a number of her contemporaries who have given up on the Communist Party USA because of its obsequiousness and its leaning to Moscow, seems to have no alternative other than an equally reformist outlook that is certainly far more revisionist than the worst days of Khrushchev in the Soviet Union. Despite these political inadequacies, the book is useful. Today's communists must become familiar with the lives and political struggles of their forebears. These were courageous men and women, many with long histories of class struggle, class combat on the front lines of the working class struggle, these leaders of the Communist Party USA that is pro-Moscow. The party they led is not the exclusive property of the present-day Communist Party USA. As a historical phenomena, it belongs to those Marxist-Leninists of today in USA and all through the world who are working to build a new communist movement that will learn from both the errors and the accomplishments of the old Communist Party. Internationalism is essential. International solidarity. In the mind of the writer, we cannot afford to allow a criticism build up to the point that will flame the passions of racism and anti-communism. So this writer is suggesting that no criticism be publicized to any degree of the Communist Party's past mistakes, because this would only lend credence and flame the hatreds of communism, the anti-communist and anti-socialist feeling in the USA today. Anyway, it's just an insight into an insider's view of the Communist Party USA and some of its twists and turns under Browder's revisionism and the left of Foster, who indeed did represent international struggle in the more classic Marxist-Leninist sense. But have to safeguard against revisionism because there are revisionist elements in the Communist Party, for instance, who thought that the mine workers' strike should be ended for fear that repression would come about. This kind of revision must be stamped out because there can only be armed struggle, armed resistance to oppression. Certainly there must be education in the USA, no recommendation of armed struggle at this point. But when mine workers are taking an assertive role, they need to be encouraged and not dissuaded from peaceful protest, their right to strike, which is even so-called safeguarded in the Republic Constitution. And it's asinine to talk, as some communists do, that we must not rock the boat in these troubled times. You can follow that course and end up with an Adolf Hitler and still say don't rock the boat because he's liable to persecute somebody that disagrees with him. It's important that we keep our radical history and our radical perspective, that it is the proper thing to do to stand up for what is right and to encourage and fan the flames of liberation and revolution, both in U.S. Babylon, which almost is hopeless because of apathy and despair, and certainly in the international struggle that has been bravely led by the Soviet Union and Cuba. And let us always hope and believe and keep them inspired by at least our thoughts and writings that the Soviet Union is doing the right thing and Cuba is doing the right thing in spite of the threats of economic boycott, stopping of trade and breaking of trade as Canada, the puppet regime of USA, has done. In spite of the new attempts at economic isolation of Cuba, they must continue to support the flames of international liberation, or there will be no hope for any principled people in the world. Thank you and much love. United States President calls for invasion of Zaire. That's not his term, but military support to the crumbling Zaire puppet dictator regime of Mobutu that has been imposed unnaturally on the Belgian Congo, the Congo which had been promised liberation by Patrice Lumumba and was murdered by the CIA. Even BBC is speechless by this request. Monday, the NATO meeting will be called to discuss a multinational pan-African military force of the world imperialist powers directed by our fascist USA that should cause us all guilt and vomitus There's warlike actions and murderous activities against the poor and the oppressed of the world. Carter has called for military units from all capitalist nations, including USA, and a Pan-African international military force to support the crumbling, murderous dictatorship of Zaire under dictator Mobutu. As new outbreaks of civil war have taken place in the northeast province of Zaire, of Katanganese, that certainly this time cannot be blamed upon the Angolans, as they are far removed from Zambia and Angola's border. So goes on the scenario of world imperialism, who feels so threatened over losing such vast uranium and cobalt and copper supplies as exist in Zaire's Katangan province. That is the news bulletin. Thank you. Much love.
Coming in today, two Hollywood movies for tonight, Walker's rally, you know, Tuesday. But study Senate Bill 1437 very well on the news that I've just given.